Can you just say something loud? I just want to see the peak of this.
Something loud?
Yeah. Good. Good, 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 good. Hey, hey, okay, great. All right, so this is set up. I'm ready on my side.
I'm ready.
How do we get here? Straight from the top. It was from Absidy. Shout out to Absidy, who you haven't seen for 18 odd years. And she's been telling me about you for quite some time. So you gotta meet this Patrick. I was like, okay, we'll see. and sure enough, you're here in Berlin. Patrick, Sam, we've been just hanging out, and that's how it started. We couldn't stop. Absidy has been saying you guys gonna do a podcast, you're gonna talk, and I was like, I don't know, let's see. And then we met, and I was like, oh my god, it was like an explosion. A lot to cover. But then the next day, I was having my usual shower thoughts in the shower and just thinking, like, Namibia, and then what you spoke about, Germany, Namibia, the forgotten genocide.
Crowds cheered as a German colonial-era statue was removed from the Namibian capital of Windhoek on Wednesday. The 7-foot, 9-inch bronze statue of Kurt von Francois was unveiled in 1965 during the city's 75-year anniversary celebrations. But the controversial statue has been seen as a symbol of colonial oppression in the southern African nation. Germany has a troubled past with Namibia. It apologised last year for its role in the massacre of Herero and Nama tribespeople over a century ago, and officially described it as a genocide for the first time. The figure is one of the latest to be taken down, as activists around the world mount campaigns for their removal.
Funny enough, yesterday morning I also had a call with my mother. And I was explaining to her, I was like, I'm going to Switzerland. Going to check out some talks, and there's a lot going on right now in society.
In Belgium, statues of King Leopold II have been targeted by anti-racism protesters. Tributes to the monarch, whose troops killed and maimed millions in Democratic Republic of Congo, were burned and sprayed during protests over the police killing of Black American George Floyd back in 2020.
Talking about the past, what does that mean for us? The excavation of the past. Patrick, you are somebody that has been engaging in a lot of these topics. One of the things we also spoke about was the topic of hypocrisy, how we relate to the past. And funny enough, my mom, she can challenge me in things, and she would say, like, so why are you digging up the past? The past is the past. You can't change the past. What is this forgotten genocide for you, Patrick? And what is the role of Germany in Namibia? What is happening today between the two countries?
Well, it's like interesting. The point is, nobody gets the privilege to think about the past, the present, and the future as like interwoven concept, right? Like a lot of people say, I'm a historian, so I only think of the past, you know, or you'll be like, well, you know, I'm into the contemporary cultures, or I am, you know, dealing with the existential crisis of the world. And so part of the challenge is a lot of like disintegration happens within who we are as human beings and what we do for human development. The first question is, who's human? And what constitutes your humanity? And I think that's the starting point, because there's a backlash for being human. People are human doings. They've been doing things that dehumanize, that humiliate. And not necessarily for like bad intent, but to survive, right? Like, so the Namibian-German history is very intense, because the context of who's human as an idea, as a philosophical exploration, has led to the consequences of the world that we experience. So Germany are explorers after the Berlin Conference. Africa is not for Africans.
Between 1904 and 1908, German colonial forces put down an uprising of local Herero and Nama minorities against the German push for land. About 80% of all Herero are believed to have been killed.
What's written here in German is, with the help of God and for emperor and empire, we're fighting the members of the Marine Expedition Corps in the following battles. And then you see a whole list of battles from 1904 where the German Schutztruppe were involved fighting the Herero and Nama people. But nowhere here is made mention of the tens of thousands of Herero and Nama people who subsequently died in these battles.
But German tourists don't understand why the Herero would want the monument gone. It's actually very stupid, because this is also their history, and it's a warning, so it won't be war again. Thousands of tourists flock to this coastal town every year. Even local Herero craftsmen are concerned about losing their German customers.
It hurt us, you see, also it hurt us, basically. But you see, that one is staying there, is people from Germany. It's part of history, you see. They come here, you see, they come to see that moment from the history.
That's what we are selling our tourists here, is the past and this colonial, this style of Swakopmund, which I think we've got a great success of.
Swakopmund was the site of one of the 5 concentration camps the German colonizers put up to imprison the local population. As documented by German authorities, none survived longer than 10 months. The skulls of the dead were sent to Berlin for racial studies. Yet very little evidence of this history can be found at the local cemetery.
And here they also put a monument here, which says that the Herero people died under the mysterious circumstances. These words, it makes me very painful, mysterious circumstances. We know the cause of death of our people. Look at those unmarked graves, thousands and thousands and thousands.
In Namibia, a battle for the memory of the colonial history is taking place. More than a century later, the wounds have still not healed.
Africa is not for Africans, because they're not human. So it's got to be somebody else. It's somebody else who has what you'd call military, but then that's substituted with power. People don't understand diversity. Therefore, they want an empire. And the homogenization of people from everywhere to be assimilated into a structure that exploits the very dignity of human beings. How does this process take place? So the principle is, we are civilized. And as German civilized society, we have institutions that are represented by scientists who go out into Namibia. A lot of ideas around eugenics bring these cranium theories of you know, the head size is like this, therefore they can't be intelligent, therefore it's okay to treat them as subhuman. 1. 2, you are a pagan. You are not sophisticated. What they'll later call the modern man. Right? So you're none of these. But actually all of this is posturing. So to summarize Namibian German history is that Germans go explore the world, get Namibia, but essentially when they come there, they have a sense of hegemony and hierarchy. So as Africans, we believe that the land doesn't belong to us. We belong to the land. So already there's a principal contestation, and you see this with a lot of indigenous communities. We belong to the land, but now all of a sudden there's a new way of thinking about, no, the land belongs to us.
What precisely does posturing mean, specifically in the context of colonial studies? Posturing refers to the way in which colonial powers present themselves and project their authority, dominance and superiority over their colonized people. Think about the various ways it is expressed, from movies, art, religion, philosophy, beauty ideals, advertising, and even finance. These are various ways in which you express the colonial powers which establish and maintain control over the colonized people. Posturing also involves performative acts, gestures and narratives that convey the colonizer's self-image as superior and benevolent, while portraying the colonized as inferior, uncivilized, and in need of guidance or control. These postures serve to legitimize and justify colonial rule, providing a moral and ideological framework for their exercise of power. Think about even the architecture that you see, grand colonial buildings, the public institutions, the museums, government palaces. These are all designed to showcase the power and authority of your colonizers. Think about the cultural soft powers, the promotion of European languages, education systems, and cultural practices. It's all with the intention of eroding indigenous cultures and replacing them with Western ideals. Have you noticed that throughout Africa, Asia, the Americas, even the most remote countries, the people will all speak at least one European language. Think about the dress and the fashion that the world has adopted. Wherever you go, what do you notice about the way people are dressed on the streets? Think about the Christian missionaries, Alliance Française, Goethe Institute, the British Museum, or the Netherlands Enterprise Agency. What narratives do they promote? And what do you think they're repressing? Think about the travel literature you may see on airplanes or in travel magazines, the kind of narrative that emphasizes the exotic and primitive aspect of the colonized societies, reinforcing Western readers' preconceptions and perpetuating stereotypes about the colonized. What other examples comes to your mind?
And what does that lead to as a consequence? That leads to an experience where, personally, I'm a Nama. Nama people were also hugely part of the genocide. But what's most significant for me today of the past is that there was a cultural genocide. The way we live, or the expression of the way we live. So that was annihilated. What does it mean when you don't have roots in this kind of context of what civilization is? But the hypocrisy is, it's not like there were not wars in Africa. There were. People were fighting for territories. Like, I'll give you an example, Yoto. It's if I'm the chief, right, and I come to your place and I defeat you and I take your people become part of my people. I don't take your people and make them slaves. They become part of this idea of us with these men who have fought, we would take you in. So it's not like war doesn't take place, it's the effects. What Germany does is at some point they come, also diamonds get discovered very early in the turn of the 19th century in Namibia, and so there's this need to capture that, right? But you're dealing with a group of people that have abundance, you know, that have a way of life, that even if there's wars, it's at low scales, 5 to 10 men die in these things. But then one of our chiefs, Captain Hendrik Witbooi, who initially gives Germans this protectorate, right, or like a science protectorate treaties, and says, you know, this part of the country you can have access to. Later on, he says, since you came, our rivers that were filled with water and are filled with blood. These actions are evidently inhumane. They are barbaric. But they're all done in the name of civilization. So how are civilized people going and exterminating people? You know, like, I don't want you to exist. That's a fundamental clash here. Do German state, German people have the right to decide who exists and who doesn't exist? And if you then chase it to say, we want to exist, do they then have the right to exterminate you?
So, Patrick, I hear what you're saying. There was absolutely the eugenics. Okay, we don't deny any of that. But what do you find in your experience and also speaking with, let's say, the German state and some of the organizations, what is so humiliating in today's terms? Okay, yeah, that was the past. Sure, that happened and we exploited, but today we want to build and expand in terms of equality and inclusion and diversity. Why is it so humiliating for you in today's terms? And what are some of the cliches that comes up for you over and over in some of these dialogues?
Oh my God, that's a great one. Because like one of the first cliches is like, it wasn't me. Right? It wasn't even my grandparents. It was from a lot longer. So just to make the historical, structural, contemporary link here is, for instance, when diamonds were discovered in Namibia, shiploads of diamonds were taken to Hamburg. They arrived in Hamburg, and a lot of the wealth that is ascertained, even contemporary context, places you in a situation where you have access to this wealth because it was built on wealth that was accumulated from the rest of the world, right? So what is humiliating are the subtleties of supremacy. So I'll give you an example. A lot of the negotiation right now at a state-to-state level, which excludes people-to-people, and remember, Namibia is only 30 years old, so the genocide happened outside the perimeters of the state that exists currently. And in the negotiation, already it's a state-to-state negotiation. And a lot of the kind of complaints from the Namibian perspective is that the affected communities, some of them are involved in the negotiations on behalf of the state. Most of them who have a critical mass aren't involved in these negotiations. So the very fundamental question is, how does the state of Namibia and the dynamics of Namibia has changed, right? So because of the genocide, there's huge population declines within certain tribes or within certain people within Namibia, particularly the Nama, the Herero, and as a result, they are outnumbered at a national level. So the big issue of trust that doesn't exist is, how is the state of Namibia negotiating on behalf of the affected communities, but because of the heterogeneous nature of Namibia, are these affected communities going to be directly impacted by whatever negotiation is? So I'll give you a practical example. In Namibia, you have commercial land, you have communal land, and you have state land. 71% of commercial land is owned by settler population. So that's mostly the German community or the white South African Afrikaners that have 71% of commercial land, which is basically arable land in the country. The other land is state parks. But then the other tribes, besides the ones that went through the genocide, have what we call communal land. Right, so if you are from mostly any of the other tribes outside of the Oshiro or the Nama people, you will have your traditional authority have some type of jurisdiction of land. So the first absence of this is that, like, the commercial land is owned by the former settler community, and the other tribes that haven't gone through the genocide have access to communal land. So when you advocate for acquiring land back, going to see the graves, you are faced with a double compounded type of resistance, both from the former advantage white community and your brothers who are from other tribes, because they don't understand why you need to fight so hard for what they call ancestral land, because this is given through communal land. So we don't have that. So for instance, a lot of tribes, the capital where the Oshiro or the Nama people are from, they will say, nobody's from there. Nobody's from these places. First of all, that principle understanding that this land didn't belong to anybody, nobody lived here, and it's both, so you can never gain critical mass. To say, yo, here are these black people that are able to at least identify, because most of them can't, because most of them still have communal land. It's only the tribes that went through the genocide. And then they say, ah, all these homeless kids in the streets are either Nama. And so the issue that's humiliating is this idea of, like, just not having dignity. And dignity is access to lights with certain rights and livelihoods. So the kind of contemporary implication is, ah, you guys are homeless, you're on the streets, there's this connotation that you're lazy, you haven't worked hard enough. It's the implications that come along with how you are perceived. So whether the truth is we come from a tribe that's known to be warriors and are very philosophically grounded and understand humanity, all of that gets changed to the Germans came and colonized you, and now also we can't deal with you because what's your value as people? The subtleties of supremacy work like that. The subtleties will come and say, oh, I'm a Südwester from Germany, and now I'm not even accustomed to Germany anymore. When I go there, it's too green. You know, I miss my browns, because Namibia is a desert, right? Like, not only do I miss my browns, but I miss this country. I walk barefoot in it. You know, I'm not scared of the animals that are there. I can, you know, look at the lions, look at the snakes. I can breathe in that oxygen. I have a level of entitlement and ownership that not even the people whose generations come from here have. And I feel no shame, because this is what the Kaiser wanted. This was the Kaiser's dream, and we are living Kaiser's dream. So the subtleties are at who's human. A lot of this has disqualified you as being human. And so you have to live a life where you don't have uncles, where you don't have family that are able to live a humanized life, because the epigenetics, the intergenerational trauma, the collective trauma that has been burdened. And the biggest problem, the biggest shame, is that nobody wants to be accountable for the cultural genocide that was committed. I almost want to say, fuck the land. It's part of it. There's a huge part around, you know, the amount of people that were murdered. But it's the displacement of a way of life, the culture, the language. You know, all of this, the body of work that comes with being Nama has been annihilated. The sense of militarism that was exposed against our people has mean our living to speak up against increasing militarism in this world. Because my ancestors understand what it means that even after 120 years, you can't build back so easily. So for me, the contestation is, how does it affect you in a contemporary context? Epigenetics shows us that because of a black man who were annihilated early, I'm struggling now with living long. You know, because now it's like, ooh, who's going to come for me? Because that's the kind of reality that you live in. I struggle now because a lot of my family deals with mental health issues. I struggle now because access to land and dignity are still on the periphery. My family struggles because during German colonial rule, interracial marriages were allowed. So my grandfather's grandfather is a German, Leonhard Scherben, who comes from this, whose family later on were also associated to like the Nazi regime, who end up in Paraguay to run away from the Nuremberg trials and all of the implications that come with having been a Nazi at the time. And what does all of this mean in terms of a physical implication, in terms of my dignity and being wholehearted? It directly puts a person into a self-fulfilling prophecy that, like, you're not human, therefore it was okay for us to come dehumanize you, to humiliate you, and then you still deal with issues of supremacy. What happens to our artifacts? Do Africans, can they really take care of it? Like, can you not ask these questions that are an extension of supremacy? Like, nobody goes and steals something and asks whether the person who you stole it from can take care of the thing. Like, what do you think happened for all those centuries before you came? Who took care of these things? These are kind of the contemporary implications.
And what is the meaning of taking care? What is that? What is the definition? For what purpose? Is it the taking care to remind all of the subjects of the supremacy? Or is it a part of the people? Who does these things, quote-unquote, belong to? I mean, even the question of belonging. But I think a lot of these topics, my head was exploding just having the one-day conversation with you, and it reminded me, it was a recent conversation I had. You said very distinctly, and the separation of what is personal versus what is political. There is this sense, the subtleties of supremacy as we return to. Let's say if I bring something up on a larger committee discussion on a system level of politeness, but there's an impossibility where at some point I have to say, look, there's a concrete reason why I'm here as a person. Why does this bother me? And then people say, well, Patrick, that's your personal business. Let's return back to a systemic level of improving humanity. How do you bring this into larger conversations? Because you are very much involved in systems where the people have to take into consideration and kind of perhaps, dare I say, get lost, conveniently ignore that. And so do you run into these personal problems and how to bring that up as a personal individual, but at the same time needing to consider the larger scale?
Self-censorship. it's okay to self-censor. I think it's like, what's the effect of it? I think the challenge is, you know, when you look at imperialism, when you look at colonialism, when you look at militarism, these fundamentally only benefit a few people. So even if you look at the effects of like wealth, land distribution, the state of climate change on the planet, it benefits very few people. And at a systemic level, for instance, let's look at like a country like France. You know, they had this huge empire. Even up until today, 14 African countries, central banks are within France. They still have to pay them back for the bridges that were built. They were da-da-da-da-da, you know. And again, I have to censor what I know about this topic because the implication is leaders in Africa have been taken out for trying to change the status quo because it's that systemic. So here's the struggle. On the one hand, I hate the idea of colonialism, right? Just going out there, being militant, taking over people, imperialism, getting resources. But on the other hand, I'm a beneficiary of this state that I live in, that is a colonizer, but also the elites within my country, the aristocrats, the proletariat, they haven't discussed this with the population. Already from an inside, if I'm French or from the British Empire living there, I was never told about what the royal family was behind, with the link of them being charged with the church, with the link of, for instance, the British East Indian Company, the Dutch East Indian Company. So there's non-state actors, you know. So there is this like vehicles of supremacy and colonialism and imperialism, but they don't all work at the same time. It's kind of been spread, the spectrum. You know, so it might be the soldiers, it might be the scientists, it might be the non-state actors, it could be the missionaries. Everybody gets like a piece of the supremacist vehicle to take care of, right? And we always, as a counter movement, just focus on the militarism or on the science, right? But we don't have a consolidated approach to say, how do we deal with this bullshit science? How do we deal with militarism? How do we deal with the missionaries coming to tell us that there's only one God, for instance? Maybe there are many gods, you know, limiting our access to the supernatural and to the magic that exists out there. And how do we deal with these non-state actors, these companies that directly obviously serve the elites within the state or within a certain monarchy? How do we deal with them? right? So there is no counter movement that can deal at scale with colonialism or imperialism. This machine needs to be congratulated for its ability to ensure that the most of the world cannot benefit from the things that are here on Earth. Only a few people can. And the context is kind of interesting because people go out there and are imperialist. And if you talk about it, they feel systemically shamed. So now the part of the power is not just that you can have a counter movement, that the counter movement at that personal level, even if you're part of a system, doesn't know how to absorb the shame that comes with it. And that's the implicit hypocrisy. And I think for us, it's not to try and separate those two things, right? Like, because a lot of the times you don't, oh, how do I not deal with the shame? It's not my responsibility to absorb that reality. I need to deal with the thing that's going to give me dignity. But power doesn't work like that. Because when you're oppressed, when you're on the periphery, you almost have to lick ass to get back into the center. And you don't have the resources. You don't have the power. You don't have the body of work that colonialism does. I mean, people even have a problem with statues being taken down, like as if they don't understand being to a history class. Like, what's the problem with the statue? The problem with the statue is that it didn't take care of all of our interest, right? It took care of a particular sect that went out there and used violence, mass violence, to ascertain a certain outcome. And the other danger is that because these people are not civilized, because they are barbaric, they're inhumane, and they're uncivilized, you see in how they treat the planet, you see in how they treat other people with messes of genocides. So then the problem is, bring this up, they must annihilate you. So there is no room for you to actually deal with imperialism. There is no room for you to actually have a critical mass, because half of the people who believe what you believe are just so afraid and have also been assimilated and have also become part of this dominant discourse that is around accumulating power, accumulating resources in the hands of the few. People are insecure because they know what they've done to you. They know that they took you out. So there is no trust that your energy is more metaphysical, that they exist outside the power of hatred. So because they exhibit that and they project that, so they don't even think that you can forgive them, right? Because they will never be able to forgive you if you did what they did to you. As an African, as a Namibian, as a Nama, as a black man, we are not imperialist. But there's no desire, because when you're not imperialist, you know the power of military. And you can't applaud yourself in being human, because other people are ashamed that they're not as human as you. So you're out-humaning them. And because, I don't know if they're cyborgs or if they're human doings, I don't know, you know, because I'm not that. I'm an indigenous man who understands my relationship with the planet, loves people, who has given energy to life, you know, when we meet, when we interact. And the spectrum for being human is increasingly narrowed. Because why more and more we are annihilating indigenous practice, or not just practices, epistemology, and replacing that with a system that people can't be wholehearted. And when people lose that energy, they can be manipulated. And essentially, they're made to celebrate these things, because if they choose to defy them, the price you pay for defying imperialism, militarism, everything is too high. You know, some of us can take a chance and speak about it because we haven't ascertained all of that. Our families are still mentally ill. We haven't got power. We don't have resources. So, you know, nothing's going to really change. If I don't say this, this is the only thing I could possibly say to save my people. But outside of that, it is systemically the normalization of imperialism, the acceptance of colonial norms, the celebration of property over people, that all culminates into this system that you call it, but this monster of a thing that can't be dismantled.
One thing I noticed about you is this willingness to acknowledge and engage in what this is also playing out within the self. You also mentioned even that Africa is carved up, not according to geography, not according to its people. It's done like with a pen and paper with a ruler.
Yeah.
This is this country, this is that country. Okay. Yeah. But then what does that mean? What does that mean to be Namibian? What does that mean to be African? What does it mean for me to be an Asian? Who is that? And for you even to say that, like, it's like, okay, well, you have the roots of the heritage of German ancestry. That's part of you. That's part of you. And then what I noticed even with some friends that I know, that let's say they have the quote-unquote these definitions of color, of mixing in them. What does that mean for you as a personal, and when the world is going to just increase in mixing, no matter how much attempt of rules that they put in, but what does that do to the psyche on an individual level and on a day-to-day level? How do we deal with this, not just the guilt and shame of like, oh, these horrible grandparents and generation of those people. What do we do with ourselves? How do you work that energy on the individual level? How do you work that? How do you get up in the morning is what I'm asking you.
You know, one of the most, the question you asked me to start there, what does it mean to be African? What does it mean to be Namibian? One of the most beautiful things that I like about being African is that we exist in multiplicity. Right, so for 400 years, they've tried to eliminate, exterminate, but you still find African culture as like the coolest, hippest. I mean, I always make this joke that the Koreans have transformed into like black people. They're like, they can like lock, pop, and drop, like, you know, but that's black culture. But if a black man does that, he doesn't get as much money as if a Korean man will do it, right? If a Chinese man is dancing or singing like an African man, then the followings, the hits on YouTube, on TikTok, are like, you know what I mean? So everybody makes money from impersonating being black except black people. Like, black people don't make money from being black, but everybody else makes money from being black. Why? But we are many things. And I think there's this idea of, you know, I even speak the language of what you, even apartheid, of the Afrikaners. Ik praat Afrikaans, maar je goed beter als hulle soms. Die begrip en die taal en is, you know. Or je kan ook een beetje Deutsch, weil ich in deutsche Schule war. Or I'm busy learning a little bit of Spanish. So part of the point is, being African means being many things. Can you imagine most of the places where there's huge amounts of colonialism and imperialism, people only speak one language? I don't know how my humanity would be reduced if I only spoke one language. I don't think there are Africans that only speak one language. There might be very few. The nature of existing on the continent requires you to do multiple things. So it's already that. So starting with how do you wake up in the morning is like knowing that there's many options you can take. It is when people's kind of self-fulfilling prophecies play out that a lot of this power is lost internally. All right, so when you just reduce it to, oh, I have to get up and go to work. Like, not like, oh, I have to get up. I mean, even when I was working hard at some point, I'm like, nah, man, I'm not getting up and not doing anything that doesn't give me pleasure. So when I get up, I know in the first 30 minutes I'm going to do something that gives me joy and pleasure, whether it's a reading or reading before I can reply to an email. All right, so being African really, really, really is about the multiplicity that exists. But interestingly, that's also how you address dominant narratives. By addressing patriarchy, by addressing misogyny, it's not like, oh, we want the queers to be the new dominant ones, right? What you want to do is you want to create multiple narratives so that many people have power, many places have significance. But hegemony doesn't allow you to do that. Hegemony allows for dominant narrative that tells single stories, but there's a danger in these single stories. So I think the birthplace for freedom, internal liberation, is your ability to tell many stories, to interact with many people, to eat as much foods. You know, so even if people are like, oh, we're environmentalists, but I only eat the prime steak, but they kill a whole cow for that. In Africa, we eat everything. You know, you drop the blood, you take it in, you cook the head, you take the intestines, because that reduces the time it'll take to cut the next cow. Because we have a relationship, and we don't just kill them, it's a sacrifice. We understand that we're sacrificing this. I think a lot of that has been put to the periphery. A lot of the understanding of multiplicity, many cultures, has been placed on the periphery so that you can become one thing and then be assimilated into this dominant narrative and then end up even protecting it. And even if you don't like it, you'll end up living it. That's what domination feels like. And so the thing that I can offer as an African, as a black man, as a Nama, is that we embrace multiplicity. Right? That's why we're not imperialists, because we don't want to go and annihilate and dominate other cultures. Because we understand there might be value, there might be beauty in the diversity of culture. And that's what we can offer the world, the ability to deal with heterogeneity. I mean, you see rising right-wing parties in Europe, but 71% of Namibia has a German population. How is it that we are okay with the migration of Germans to Namibia and to the entire world, but the Europeans are freaking out about migration? Because they don't have a collective imagination. Why? The relationship between the people of Europe and their state must be questioned. Because our relationship between our people and our state is questioned. And a lot of the times, like in these colonial countries, a lot of people will be like, yeah, we have a problem with this spectrum. But just let them speak to a Namibian where Germany was a colonist. Then they'll take the exact same position of their state. And I think that's where you start to dismantle power. in what close proximity are you to the position of your state or to the position of the people of the country? And I think people struggle when they come from imperialist past to navigate that space.
Well, you're in Germany right now, Patrick.
Yeah.
And as they say, when in Rome.
Ooh.
And what about this idea of we respect your rules when we come to your house and we're in Germany, so you should do what we do here. How does a German-born German think about that? Okay, we're not, let's say in Germany, it's not Namibia. There is not this external colonizing, but we feel this threat. Whoa, look at you coming in from outside, bringing all these languages and all these ideas. Hey, this is not how we've been doing things. Okay, well, I agree with you. Maybe it was a bad idea to go to Namibia in the first place. But let's not repeat that.
By you coming here.
Yeah, well, but so let's, I agree with you. Don't come, go back to where you come from. Go back to where you come from.
Part of a kind of global elite movement has been able to kind of capture us as a nation state, as tribes, you know, but those are all like disaggregated things. So if you aggregate all these things to like, okay, we're all humanity, right? It's humans we're dealing with. There has to be universality. And there has to be like a basic minimum standard for what qualifies this idea of universality, right? This is where, after the Second World War, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights comes from. That no matter where you are, no matter where you're from, there's something that brings us together at this human level. But a lot of the body of work in colonial countries doesn't give you that ability to understand from a human perspective. So like, is there humility with this hegemony that exists? There probably doesn't, right? So there is also an emotional maturity that exists. There's a lot of lack. As much as there's lack in African context, there's also a lot of lack here, particularly when it comes to universality. So what's universal amongst us is what I would ask a German person that comes here, right? Because a lot of the knock-on effects of what happens in, for instance, Ukraine, for what happens in Syria, for what happens in Afghanistan, is a knock-on effect from what happens from these imperialist states. What is then the expectation of the turnaround in terms of saying our politics affects you? So the question is the normalization of supremacy. And as a population, as people, even if the state is doing it, there's some kind of trickle-down effects of this notion of supremacy. And part of those trickle-down effects is that Germany is for die Leute, die wie so Deutsch sprechen, and they look a particular way. This is not very far from like Nazi ideology in terms of being an Aryan state in whose interests you preserve. And it's okay to openly say, this is the Germany that we want. The reality is that's not how the world works. There are borders, there are seas, there are boundaries. People will come to a place where their safety is guaranteed. So the choices are, if you want the Germany that you have imagined, you have to extend that imagination to think that I also want that same thing as a person. So how does the non-state actors from these imperialist states affect the reality in these countries? Right? So you can say, we want this Germany where there's only white people, we only speak one language. That's great. But at the same time, understand that you have to advocate for your country's not interfering into the status of others, making sure they get the resources from them, making sure that they endorse political elites that don't serve the interests of the people, making sure that the elections in those countries are not rigged, because it'll come back and bite you in the ass. Right? So you can't have it two ways. You can't have your bread buttered on both sides. And that's why the migration issue is at the rate that it is. You can't just come to Africa, take its resources, and expect no effect. That's not how the value chain works. So I can give you the Germany that you want if you give me the Africa I want. Otherwise, we both don't get what we want. Right? So pick a battle. And that's the truth. Supremacists and the colonialists and the imperialists, they're not used to, because they use military and then they tell stories with the historians and then the scientists do their work. They all work in cahoots together. But we don't think that because we've never put those puzzles together. So we cannot dismantle this thing. But the only thing we can do is then speak about the unspoken truth and hope that there is some form of critical mass, that people have the power to then stand up and people have the power to transcend energy that opens up your blind spots, right? But if you don't even think I'm intellectual, if you don't even think I have power or I have the ability to connect us and save this planet. So the argument that my boy Mushiva makes as a rapper also who lives in Berlin is that you all want to become environmentalist, but you can't be an environmentalist if you're not going to understand how black bodies have been part of this. Where does the exploitation come from? The mining, the fracking. Whose bodies are used there? So only way you can change that is if you're interested in black bodies, because if black bodies are not used, there will be less exploitation to then minimize the implications there on the planet. Because the world has agreed, and I'll give you an example, you know, even within the Asian context, I'm always surprised when people are like, oh, China, human rights violations. Like, they've done such a good job at PRing that. But America has a historical system that has treated black people not just like slaves that they've built the country, but continuously till today shows young black boys that it's not in their hands to live as long as they want. But they are the beacon of democracy. The hypocrisy is so embedded in supremacy that awakening people, they might just take you out. Because they're so ashamed of a lack of their humanity. And that's how we'll win this thing. 60% of the world's population is going to be African. Because white people lost connection. But the people in Africa are still putting in. The babies are being born. Right? So there's just no way, after everything that's been done by the church, by the soldiers, by the scientists, the black people are still here, our culture is still influential. We're not going anywhere. We're not going anywhere. Because why? We will out-human you. We'll out-love you. We'll out-connect you. That is our mission. That's how we're going to get the planet back. And you can't defy that. It's mystical. It's mysterious. And we bring that kind of power to this discourse. And people don't like that. People don't like the fact that you laugh hard. People don't like the fact that you play music that is jazz. People don't like the fact that you have life in you. They just don't. All right? But that's what's going to sustain, because this is about energy. And energy doesn't die. It just transforms.
I want to add to that discourse that you had on the idea of imposter syndrome. You had a really good saying. Tell me about that.
Well, so Namibia becomes independent, so I'm older than my country. All right, so already, can you imagine like the type of political conversations I've been in when you're older than your country, understanding apartheid, colonialism, and then you go to these schools and you're one of the first black kids dragged into like an all-white school, and it's like a British school, so it's like Harry Potter minus magic type vibes, right? Like, good morning, Mrs. Hathorn Sweden, thank you for the lesson. Pull up your socks, tuck in your shirt, keep to the left. And then you're just there, Oliver, never before. Just like that, you're just so British. And then you go to a German school and it's like, wer kennen in die Wend took a Berge. And then you end up going to an international school in the US, which is kind of like a prep school. You go to the Netherlands, and this whole time people can't believe, oh, your English is so articulate and your energy is just so this and that. I'm like, what did you know about black people or my energy or my culture or my people before you met me that you were so overwhelmed by this? And all of a sudden, you feel disconnected because you start noticing that people who grew up with more privilege, with more supremacy, they almost start resenting you for your being.
Do they say, Patrick, but you're so privileged. What are you complaining? I didn't go to all those schools and all those education, all these places.
Then what they'll do is they're like, oh, you must be like this because you went to Columbia University. I'm like, no, Columbia only accepted me because I was like this. Right? Like, the narrative starts to get like, oh, attached to some other existing dominant narrative. It can't be that an indigenous boy came and is able to think and speak. And then I started feeling weird, my energy, like, yo, people want to be, like, they don't want to be you, almost like they want to steal your energy, like a vampire. Like, they don't want your blood, but they want your energy. I started feeling that. And then obviously in the psychosocial world, you know, the terms like imposter syndrome came out, where people feel like a fraud for being a certain way. But the truth is, like, I grew up with like my grandparents, my grandfather, my family, my friends. There's no way that I feel displaced. But I started to feel displaced around people who didn't know what energy was or had energy as a currency. And then for many years, they were like, oh, do I have imposter syndrome? Because at some point, I also couldn't become immersive. But I didn't realize the reason why wasn't because of who I am, it was my epigenetics. I wasn't answering the calls of my ancestors, of my people in being human, right? And a lot of these spaces that I was in would almost like idolize me in a way that felt uncomfortable. Like, how does it happen that you get these grades? How does it happen that you cried? You know, so I had to take a step back and be like, no, this is actually not about me. Because part of capitalism and part of imperialism, it's had as a very hyper-individualistic paradigm. So everything has to be about you. And then I thought, no. I have an imposed syndrome. I have a syndrome where people have imposed their norms around supremacy, who gets to enter the room, who sits on the table, how articulate. And they've imposed this thing because you know, even in the cultural space where I've been a cultural leader globally, a lot of the times when we go to a music event, I'll start dancing. Hey, and the ancestors wake up, you know. People are like, oh, Patrick, you're very childlike. Kind of as a way to be like, remove power from me, right? And I'll be like, that's not what they say in the boardroom. Right? Because the truth is, in the boardroom, I can tell you as a white man, can you please stop turning pink when you disagree with me, or stop smiling when you agree with me? Because the truth is, don't take everything I say so personal. Why are you like, why do you want to vet everything I say so personal? And the interesting thing I was telling you, that a lot of the times when I work with white men, one of us loses the job. Up until recently, where I had to self-censor myself throughout the whole process. Because it's like, whoa, you shouldn't. It's not the fact that I know these things. It is the fact that these people didn't think I knew these things. And then they then have to go with like, start, instead of just not having an opinion, you thought so much shit that you put me at like a minus 10. And then when I become a 10, you have to climb 20 steps. And now you're overwhelmed because you have never done that. Right? I'm like, just don't think. Don't have this prejudice. Just come in with an open mind, with a neutral mind. And then when you meet me, you're like, oh, this guy's a 10. Right? Then I've climbed 10 steps, but don't put me at fucking minus 10. And then when I end up at 10, now you're overwhelmed. Now I must be a fraud. I'm not a fraud. You've imposed a lot of these things because either my parents must be diplomats. They don't get it that my parents don't actually care about the systemic life. My parents live free lives outside of the system. It has to be associated with an existing source of power. And I am not from any of the sources of power. And a lot of the times I defy the decorum in those places, but I have the acumen that looks like, oh, I must have, you know, been birthed in this blue blood, or that my story is not accepted in the space, place, and meaning within which it exists. It has to be told, oh, it's because you went to Germany, or it's because you went to the school, or because you were trained in America. It cannot be, because I'm an indigenous boy who grew up on the streets, who understands that where he comes from, any mistake could kill him. So he doesn't make many mistakes. Because he appreciates life. He's been raised by elders who want greater inclusion and equity. Those are the values that drive us. I'm not driven by just my individual or my single aspirations. How boring. If that was the case, hey guys, it would be a different world.
You have this piece on congratulating colonialism.
Yo, I don't know if I'll ever finish. Well, you know, obviously as a poet as well, as a writer, as a storyteller, a lot of my training comes from like a little bit of history, social sciences, intersectional kind of stuff. And it's like colonialism is so insidious. Like, you know, it just like births itself. Like it's so fertile, the world. It's fertilized the world with colonialism that you just need to like, you just need to spit on it if you're a little bit of a supremacist, and then it'll just like poppy seeds off. I was just supremacist everywhere. So I want to congratulate colonialism. Because remember, there's been a lot of counter-imperial movements. And this girl just like repackages, just turns herself. Because of the inequality that still persists, colonialism has been a big driver of this. And at some point, I'm being insidious by saying congratulating colonialism, because I just don't ever feel like we'll ever overcome it. And I really don't want to die having fought this thing that's been so insidious for so many years, and then lose my life in terms of pleasure, in terms of enjoyment, in terms of connection, in terms of love. I don't want to be a bitter old African alcoholic academic because I just can't seem to find place where there's joy. Right, so a lot of this movement of imperialism is to take the joy out of you, to turn you into a slave. So I don't want to be that person. Like, I still will love people. I still connect beyond race. I still connect beyond class. I still connect beyond gender. I love humanity. And I think one of the things that I have to do is concede to this thing of colonialism that I single-handedly, without a critical mass, but even if there is a critical mass, even if there is a civil rights movement, even if more African countries are independent, these people just, I don't know what it is that they know that we don't know, but it almost seems like, yo, I well done, guys. You know, we've tried for so long, but even your population will take up your position. Even friends that I know that are caring, as soon as I have to criticize the structures of colonialism, they're like, no, but don't you feel like, you know, like, I'm like, huh? But you and I were kicking it. You know, we were agreeing on many other things. Until I started talking about your property in Connecticut. Then you're like, wait, what do you mean? Like, do you want to reparations? What is that? Do you want to redistribute wealth? So this thing's very, very, very... I've not seen anything as intricate. And remember, I'm intrigued by complex theory. Right? So I'm just trying to work on this piece that, you know, starts with the Portuguese going to explore, but the need for categorizing people as negros, as niggers, looking at the evolution from there. I'm sure indigenous people in Native America look at this and they wonder, how did this land and how did the history of this even be defined as Christopher Columbus discovered that, and how is that still the truth in 2023, and why must we work so hard to like just tell everybody that it was a lie that you believed, and like people said, no, but Christopher Columbus, like, it's still a reference. It's because people aren't seen. And then when you want to become seen, then you're like, ugh, really? It's too much work to like rethink that Christopher Columbus didn't discover America. And it carries on. So I struggle with what fuels colonialism, what fuels supremacy, what fuels, and I think it's not one thing. I think it's like a many little things, many big things, many metal things that come together to this body of work. The issues around cognitive dissonance is, I mean, just like huge cognitive dissonance when it comes to these gaps around humanity. Why? Because they've consolidated the idea of a nation state. You know, like the elites were good at this thing. So, yes, I'm working on this piece called Congratulating Colonialism just because I don't know what else to do. Like, I don't know what else to do. So at least I'll be the guy that's like, you know what, I was able to go to a party and live and laugh with some supremacists and be all right with them because I acknowledge that this thing is way beyond any power that I can ascertain within my life. So it's really struggling. It's a struggle to acknowledge that this is going, it comes from way beyond you. It's going to be there way after you, because just here, even in Berlin, like even people who are more open-minded, more open-hearted, they struggle with how to navigate the past, the present, and the future, right? Because then in that process, you'll have to lose your grandparents who are Nazis if you really want to become and live your truth. And so what we end up doing is, as oppressed people, we end up protecting the ones that we love who are supremacists. This is the same thing with the patriarchy, right? There's so much norms around what it means to be a man that if I tell the guys, yo, man, don't call the girl that you slept with last night a bitch. Oh, man, why are you acting up like that, man? You know how that's how we talk, you know? That's just how it is. Oh, now you're trying to be woke, right? But it's like, nah, why would you share yourself intimately with somebody and then, like, dehumanize them the next day? So this is not just in the colonial context. I think the issues are on supremacy. And how, whether it's your boss, the hierarchy, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, fuck the hierarchy, really. If you understand indigenous sacred geometry, you'll understand, you know, like circles and circular movements and circular economies and letting things exist on a spectrum that as a human, your energy contracts and it expands, redefining this idea of indigeneity. How do you flex between the people, the planet, and prosperity? You know, what does that look like? And how do we redesign a collective imagination? You know, I was in eastern Mexico with the Totonaco and the Nahuatl communities that have a completely different understanding of, like, not even having a purpose, that you come to Earth because everything's already been designed. Everything's already joyous. Second one around, like, how do you deal with emotion, with, like, learning from the elements of water, looking at issues around fire, what you can create, what you can't create, looking at elements of how those ideas that you create spread through the wind, you know, so really bring ourselves back to the natural elements in nature and using that understanding to kind of, you know, it's really weird to me, like in Europe a lot of the times, where people are like, everybody that's a thinker was like born goddamn five, six, ten centuries ago. There are no contemporary philosophers that are coming out of Europe currently. Or if they are, I know very little about them. But what I've learned in my academic discourse is, oh, all these philosophers that lived. I'm like, where are the great European philosophers of the contemporary times? I can tell you one in Africa. Actually, Mbembe is out there talking about, you know, the nature of necropolitics and all of these issues. So I'm asking Europe, where are your thinkers, your contemporary thinkers? Why is everything so ancient and outdated, and everybody that you guys worship and think about is like the Heideggers and the Schopenhauers and the, you know, like, ugh, I don't even want to know their names. The response to congratulating colonialism is making contemporary Europeans and people that come from these imperial states, because just because the state is imperialism, the people are imperial, right? But it's for them to understand the distinction. And it's for them to understand how they get assimilated into imperialist politics of the states when the people actually care about other people. And how do they navigate and move around in that space, and how does the energy, because a lot of the work they do removes energy from them, but gives them safety, gives them household income, gives them 10 days off, 20 days off in a year. So yeah, my work in terms of even my brother's work as a poet, Keith Black, really looks at the issues of rehumanization. How do we rehumanize these institutions of colonialism? How do we rehumanize these institutions of imperialism? How do we rehumanize the state, the churches? How do we rehumanize trade, connection? But I think we really want to work on a rehumanizing movement. And it's important to tell imperialists and colonialists that, like, we have the heart that you don't have. And it's okay for you not to trust us initially, but at least try and connect. That we can rebirth that energy into connection, into love, into empathy, into compassion. I think those are important. Yeah, and I think you know, the advice is what indigenous people tell us a lot is the sources of our energy, right? Like, a lot of our sources are libraries, but the libraries have already been captured. So I think we need to redirect, and people need to question, what is the source of your energy? And I think in that, we'll come closer to uncovering a world where we can have a collective imagination, and it's not so hyperly individualistic. And that comes through what we're doing now, right? Like hitting it up, conversing, and then saying, where does the empathy come from in your blind spots, in my blind spots? And that's why I like your questions, because you were like trying to talk to your audience in a way that doesn't shame them, in a way that still acknowledges their humanity, in a way that they're still able to say, you know what, life is hypocritical, I have internal hypocrisies, but I can build from there. And the truth is, every human seeks connection. All communities want to be significant. But if we don't have the imagination for that, because remember, these colonialists went out of their imagination of how they can conquer the world. And it happened. Therefore, in the imagination, Christopher Columbus discovered a place where people were living. So how do we then rehumanize our collective imagination?